Well, today we close our series, and we could probably go for quite a long time talking about various things, but it's an interesting concept. If you're joining us for the first time, I don't usually sound like this, so I'm going to, some of you want my Barry White imitation, don't you? yeah, that's right. I remember, you know, when I was in the South, when I was in North Carolina, South Carolina, and I go to the preachers, and these guys would preach till they got hoarse, and then they would sound like this, and so I could do my good Southern preaching, but I don't think I will do that. We're going to do something really fun. You probably have already caught on to it this summer, and the summer's just around the corner. Can you believe it? I mean, next week is May, so heads up. All of you children and, you know, husbands. And I know she's not my mother, but Mother's Day is just 2 weeks from today. So, all right. So, okay, you're duly warned. All right. But I'm gonna have you help me put a series together. And we're going to call it You Asked For It. And it's going to be your deep theological questions. And then Amy and Chris are going to answer all of them for you. Okay, I'll help. Sometimes I get ideas. Sometimes people say, hey, have you ever preached a message about, in fact, Mike and I were talking about some ideas today. We had an excellent one. But sometimes you have Bible questions, and maybe some of the Bible questions aren't, maybe they aren't like a whole message, but it's like, you know, if you took 10 minutes, you could answer. So we might combine some things thematically. They might be a Bible question. It might be about relationships. Might be about marriage. You know, the world's trying to redefine that. Might be about something, maybe something theological. Maybe it's something about the church. You know, maybe capital C church or Hillside church. You know, why do we do this? So we're going to put together a series and call it You Asked For It. I know that's real, real creative. Inside, and you'll see these the next number of weeks, you see a card says that says, you know, here's a place for your question. Use the back if you need to, if it's got a big, long question. I'm also going to be putting up a Facebook page so that you can submit questions. I thought it would be a good idea just to do that, have something online, and then I could talk to Chris. I don't know if we can do something where you could submit questions online as well, and then we'll make a link from the email so that you could do that. But it'll be fun. And it'll be a fun draw this summer, and so you certainly, and I probably won't announce which questions I'm going to answer. That way, you have to come to all of them. So right, but see, there's strategy in this. But I just thought it'd be a great time. I know pastors who will literally take a time after their message. You know, they'll do a message. Maybe they're going through a book of the Bible, and then at the end, they'll just field some questions that came on you know, Twitter, you know, Facebook, or whatever. And it's kind of a fun thing. So I thought we could do that, and it'll be great. So and if I don't know the answer, I'll just ask my wife. So because she, you know, she controls my life. So anyway, but yeah, she's got the answers. But anyway, if you've missed all the previous weeks or any of the previous weeks, we've been talking about Christian atheism. Now that sounds a little bit, you know, like a strange term. I mean, it sounds like that's something, you know, what's a Christian atheist? Of course, we know what an atheist is. And by the way, if you study atheism at all, you'll find out that atheism, actually the definition of it, is changing over the years as well. Some people wouldn't say, no, atheism isn't not believing in God or not believing there is a God. They kind of redefine it more in a new age way. But simply, an atheist is a person who lives, at least, as if God doesn't exist. We can conclude that. It doesn't mean that atheists are horrible people. You know, I know atheists that are nice, contributing citizens, and so forth. So what's a Christian atheist? And right there in your outline there, the very first thing we've been just kind of defining that, and you've already got it, is that a Christian atheist is somebody who believes in God, would call themselves a Christian, but lives as if God doesn't exist. We've all had times in our lives, moments, maybe even moments throughout a day, where we've lived that way. And, you know, whether we forget or just kind of get selfish enough that we don't take in our mind that, hey, God's watching, Jesus is right here, and so we live a certain way. But the first week, we talked about cultural Christianity, where we basically say, hey, yeah, of course I'm a Christian. I mean, I'm not a Buddhist, or I'm not a Muslim, or, you know, I'm born in America, so, you know, isn't everybody a Christian? And in the Bay Area, we don't say that so much. Nobody says, well, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, of course I'm a Christian. Right? but some of you, maybe if you grew up in the South or you're in the Bible Belt, you say, well, of course I'm a Christian. And that makes more sense. But then we talked about, the next week, we talked about customized Christianity, where we like to pick and choose. We kind of like to pick characteristics, especially about God. You ever had heard somebody, and I've heard this a number of times, people say, well, I don't believe in a God like that. I don't believe in a God who would send people to hell. And, you know, it's interesting. I was watching a thing on the History Channel, and it was like, I was thinking, isn't it interesting that, you know, and they were talking about how they honor people's beliefs. They were in a particular church. They said, we honor all beliefs. And I thought, isn't it kind of sad and scary that, you know, people can believe whatever they want, but it's not necessarily true. And it's, you know, what's true? You know, what is the truth? That's what we should be trusting in. So we talked about that customized Christianity, and we probably all have parts that we like. Hey, let's be honest. If you're a devoted follower of Jesus Christ and you've completely surrendered to Him, nobody likes the hell part of the story, right? I mean, let's just be honest for a moment. I have friends in hell. I have family members in hell. And that keeps me up at night, you know. And that's what absolutely, and I can get myself started, and I'll hone it in here, but and you're the same way. I don't like that part. And yet, you know what? I read Scripture. I know what God's Word says, and I have to accept it. So we like to customize things. We all have that tendency. Last week we talked about our tendency to be comfortable Christians, and that is we believe God, but we don't want to go overboard, you know. So you see that, and you know sometimes you've seen people who are fanatical. In other words, we don't want to be the kind of Christian that we see in some football fans, right? Yes, we love Jesus, but I don't want to paint my face and my body and wear crazy hats, you know, and say, I love Jesus, right? Let's keep this under control. And so we don't want to look too wild and crazy, and we're so afraid of offending people. But sometimes, we talked about, sometimes our tendency to be comfortable, to not be offensive, not go overboard, is really because we don't have a strong confidence that the gospel changes lives. It's kind of like we still sort of think that we have to convince people, that we have to kind of argue people or, you know, rationalize or be smarter than them. And I'm finding more and more, the older I get, that, you know, I can present the gospel and I present what Jesus did and then let it go. Let them deal with God. And instead of me trying to, you know, I try to persuade. In fact, even Paul, you know, had times when he was trying to persuade people to be a Christian. But at the same time, we realize that we could do all that we can do, and then we can finally say, okay, the responsibility lies with them. So today, I want to start off our question with our time together with this. How many of you, I mean, you just know, in your personality, like to be in control? There was some of you, if you didn't raise your hand, I was going to point you out to you. Okay. I wasn't going to mention Alan or anybody, but you know what I'm saying? I'm deep friends with some of you enough, you know, to know that. So today, why did I pick on you? He almost was preaching today for me. So said he was going to get a Ricky Nelson wig, and he was going to preach. So it was going to be really something. Stay tuned. This could get worse. But we're going to talk about controlled Christianity. And what is that? Controlled Christianity is really we believe in God. We say we're Christians. We trust in God, but we don't trust Him fully. We don't trust Him fully. Now, I said how many of you like to be in control. How many of you, and I'm not going to point out to anybody, but how many of you would say, it's kind of like, you know, when you're a computer person, you say, okay, I'm a geek. I admit it, you know, and that's a good term now. How many of you would say, okay, I am a control freak? Yeah, thank you very much. Really? I didn't know that. Some nice people. Oh, is that right? People are raising other people's hands, which makes me then wonder, who's the control freak? I don't know. It's that's confusing, isn't it? Oh, yeah. But you know what? There is some isolated things that we like to control. And for example, some of you are remote control freaks. That's all. One has batteries and one doesn't, right? That's awesome. Some of you are control freaks. If you go out to dinner, you know where you're going to eat. And I'm not this way, strangely, but how many of you guys are control freaks when it comes to driving? You have to drive. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. And that's kind of a common guy thing. You have to drive. Or maybe it's not, you know, but I hate driving, so I'm delighted that my wife loves to drive. You know, of course, yeah. And if you don't drive, then you have to criticize the person who's driving. You know, that's just the job. But some of you are control. You like to control. It's kind of a shopping control. And that, in other words, when you buy something, you have to research it thoroughly. You know, thank you, Google. Research it thoroughly, Consumer Reports, all that kind of stuff, and you know, and find the best price before you'll buy anything. You know, you don't even say the R word, retail, in your house, right? Because you would never pay. You search, and what's the best? And maybe you would, but maybe you'd find out what's the very, very best. Some of you are like that. You just say, that's good stewardship. Yeah, but some of you, hours and hours and hours and hours. But now, while some of you are, you know, you say, okay, I'm an admitted control freak, I am a self-admitted anti-control freak. Now, I'm not against you as a person, but and that may sound okay, but it's probably worse and more spiritually damaging. And here's why. See, I like to control and be in control. That's fine, but that's not my biggest problem. I am very, very resistant to anyone trying to control me. I don't mind help, I don't mind suggestions, motivation, even influence, that kind of thing. But I really push back, and maybe you're this way too. When somebody says, you need to, you have to, you know, you'd better. You know, you stop doing, you know, start doing, right? Okay, there is nothing that shuts me down more. You know what you need to do? You need to, okay, so you guys are nodding. Okay, I thought I was going to have to go on some special medication, but I guess I'm not. But I am very, and you can ask my wife, I just totally push people away. Nothing shuts me down faster. I'm very much a words person. So if somebody says, hey, I got a good idea, what if we did this? I am like all ears and wide open. I love suggestions. I love brainstorming. But somebody's saying, you better, you know what you need to do? You have to. So some of you are like that too. Now that sounds, you're saying, well, that's a good thing because, you know, sometimes people will manipulate you. But here's the problem. What if it's God instructing us? Over and over in Scripture, God gives us commands. Stop. Watch. Go. Move. You know, and sometimes God doesn't, you know, we call them the Ten Commandments, not the Ten Suggestions. Right? That wasn't a kumbaya moment where God was saying, hey, I got an idea. No. God was saying, these are commands. And so we can say, oh, that's all fine. And of course, you might say, of course I trust in God fully, but all of us probably have some area in our life that we struggle with wanting to control. It may be an area, it may be a person, I don't know. I read a great article this week, a very short article by Perry Noble. He's a pastor in South Carolina. He's got lots of locations. But he talked about the five top most difficult areas to trust God with, in his opinion. But I thought they were pretty good. He said number one was career. Number two, and you know, our future and what we're going to do and all that. Number two is our kids. And he's got a daughter, so he knows what that's like. Our kids. Third, he says our relationships. And I thought, okay, so far, so good. The other one was, the fourth one was one I didn't think about, and he calls it our other life. And I thought, what's that? And he basically says, you know, it's that secret part of us. It might be a secret temptation, a secret habit, a secret sin, a quirk, a personality flaw, something, you know, a fear of some kind, something that we don't want anyone else to know about, but it's also the thing that keeps us from really letting God be the Lord of completely of our life, completely of that area. And of course, number five was money. You would have known that, thought that, right? Okay, trusting God with those thing areas. Career, kids, relationships, our other life, whatever that might be, and money. He said those are the top five. Today we're going to start, though, back in the Old Testament, and we're going to look at God's people, the children of Israel. They're about to cross the Jordan River into the Promised Land. God's delivered them, but God wanted them to understand something really, really important. He wanted them to understand that they weren't getting this blessing because they were good, because they deserved it, because they did such a great job. They're receiving it because God is so good. And this is what we read, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 23. It's there in your listening guide, or it'll be up here as well. And this is a picture of that region that Moses would have been looking at. Verse 23 says, "And when the Lord sent you out of Kadesh Barnea," and that was a chief site of encampment for the Israelites. You see that if you read through the Exodus, you'll see that Kadesh Barnea mentioned a lot during their wandering in the wilderness. That was kind of a site right there. But he says, I sent you out from Kadesh Barnea. He said, "Go up and take possession of the land I've given you. But you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. You did not trust him or obey him." They did not trust him or obey him. Our problem is that we have, and a partially surrendered life. We'll give him some areas of our life, but don't trust him with everything. It reminds me of that that famous Bible passage, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Take a look at it. It's not in your notes here, but it's on the screen there. Very, very special verse. "Trust in the Lord with some of your heart. Lean on your own understanding in some of your ways. Acknowledge him, and you can make your own path straight." That is the PSV version, the partially surrendered version. That's not the Bible. That's not a version of the Bible. It's actually a perversion of the Bible. And unfortunately, though, if you look at it, it's actually the way we kind of live it. Right? We love that verse. That verse is very precious to some of us. And yet that verse right there, that is many times the way we live it practically. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about the partially surrendered life. All right? The first thing I want just to see in the partially surrendered life is, first of all, right there under your notes, is we when we have this partially surrendered life, we say to ourselves, you know, "I'll give God some things, but not everything." We tend to be selective with our trust in God. It's kind of like, I'll give you Sunday mornings for church, if I have time, but then I make the decisions what I do on the weekends. Friday nights, Saturday nights, that's mine. Hey, I'll give you a few minutes, first thing in the morning, some quiet time, but I'm not going to give you any of my income. I'll give you the first of my day, but I'm not going to give you the first of my income. I'll trust you with my salvation. I really, really want that heaven part, and I don't want that hell part. I'll really do that. But as for my kids, their career and their future and their agenda, I'm just kind of afraid. What if you send them far away from me or to the mission field or something? I'll take care of that part and help them with that. I'll follow the church on Facebook, but don't ask me to serve, right? I'll give you some things. I'm just too busy for that. The second thing also with a partially surrendered life is that, we'll never fully experience God's purpose if we hold back. This even affects the way we think. God, I believe you listen to their prayers, but I really don't know that you're listening to my prayers. I remember going into the hospital and visiting somebody one time, and I think I've mentioned this before, but it just made such an impact on me, and I could still see the picture. And I walked in, and there were so many people from Hillside surrounding this lady's bed that it was like, I almost just thought, wow, I should just go back. So many people were loving on her, caring for her. It was just incredible. And I walked in, and she saw me. She said, "Oh, Pastor, you're here. Now you can pray. And written, you know, between the lines was, you know, these knuckleheads, I mean, they can try. But I mean, you got some kind of special connection. And I'm thinking, oh, if she only knew, you know. And the truth of it is sometimes we feel that way about others. We see that, well, they're so spiritual, obviously. You know, they get answers to their prayers. I mean, you know, just listen to them, talk about it. But God doesn't listen to my prayers or hear me as much. And I know you're a God of grace, but I just don't feel like your mercy applies to me. I mean, everybody else has that assurance of God's forgiveness. Of course, God forgives all everybody else. But I just don't feel like, you know, that can really apply to me. I don't really trust that. I believe you, God, but I just can't trust you completely. You know, Lord, I'm worried about this. Okay, I'm going to give this to you. Okay, you're not really moving fast enough. I better take this back, right? We've done that and back and forth. I want to trust you with everything. It's just that I want to decide, you know, what movies I watch. I mean, I want you to decide, you know, where I go in my life and all that, but I really want to decide who, you know, what people I hang out with. You know, I mean, come on, there's some things that just parts of me. And I think we all have, whether it's areas or moments, or circumstances, or situations when we just kind of say and act as if God doesn't exist. Charles Blondin was a French tightrope walker, and he was the first person to tightrope walk across the Niagara Falls. There's a really great story about him. This is actually a children's story off of the History Channel, but I thought it was such a great illustration because it kind of tells historically some facts, and so I wanted to show this for you just for a couple minutes.
Jean-Francois Gravelet, better known as Blondin, was a famous tightrope walker and acrobat. He's perhaps best known for his many crossings of a tightrope, 1,100 feet in length, suspended 160 feet above Niagara Falls in the USA. His act would be watched by large crowds and begin with a relatively simple crossing using a balancing pole. Then he would throw away the pole and amaze the onlookers. On one occasion, he crossed the tightrope on stilts. On another occasion, blindfolded. Another time, he stopped halfway to cook and eat an omelette. In 1860, a royal party from England came to watch Blondin perform. After his normal spectacular crossings, he then wheeled a wheelbarrow from one side to the other as the crowd cheered. Next, he put a sack of potatoes into the wheelbarrow and wheeled that across. The crowd cheered louder. Then he approached the royal party and asked the Duke of Newcastle, "Do you believe that I could take a man across the tightrope in this wheelbarrow?"
"Yes, I do," said the Duke.
"Ah, hop in," replied Blondin. The crowd fell silent. But the Duke of Newcastle would not accept Blondin's challenge. "Is there anyone else here who believes I could do it?" asked Blondin. No one was willing to volunteer. Eventually, an old woman stepped out of the crowd and climbed into the wheelbarrow. Blondin wheeled her all the way across and all the way back. The old woman was Blondin's mother, the only person willing to put her life in his hands.
So you know where I'm going with this. Kind of amazing. I believe, you know, I believe you can. I just don't believe you enough to trust you with my life, you know. Have you found that people have a lot of faith when it comes to your life? Right? You know, I've got people that have got wonderful plans for my life, and they'll exercise all kinds of faith for my life. And that's a tendency. And we, rightfully, we feel the same way. When we're outside of it, they'll say, "Oh, I don't know, should I trust God?" And we're going, "Of course you should. Come on." You know, and it's like, "Yeah, but that's your life." But you know, I have people give me faith advice all the time, but often it's from people who are taking no risks of their own. You find that? Peter was a real hothead. But you know what? I take faith advice from Peter. You know why I would take faith advice from Peter? Because he exercised faith. I mean, yeah, he had a temper and he said some pretty stupid things, but God did some amazing things. I mean, he saw Jesus walking on a stormy sea one time and he calls out while Jesus is walking on the stormy water. He goes, hey, that looks like a great idea. Can I come and walk with you? I mean, could you imagine? He's in a perfectly good boat, you know? It's like jumping out of an airplane. You know, why would you want to do that? He gets, but look what happens. So Jesus says in Matthew 14:29, he says, come. He said, then Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. Now we know the rest of the story where he started to sink. But sink or not, I would have liked to have been him, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to say, I got out of the boat. We want to have a miraculous life. I want to have a miraculous life and experience the power of God, but most of us aren't willing to get out of the boat, whatever that means. You know, I want to walk on the water, but I'm not willing to get out of the boat. See? The third thing is that I want you to know is something really important. See, when he was walking on the water, he wasn't alone. He wasn't by himself. Peter wasn't just, you know, it wasn't Jesus inside the boat, and Peter said, hey, Jesus, I got an idea. Send me out to go walk on the water. I want you to see something really important in all of this. This isn't a matter of willpower. This isn't a matter of you, you know, just having a personality that's type A that just says, okay, I'm going to go for it. I don't care what anybody says. What you need to understand, and I need to understand, is we're not alone in our faith struggles. In Mark chapter 9, we read about a dad who brings his demon-possessed son to Jesus, and the demon controlled the boy to the extent that that the boy couldn't talk. It says he had seizures, and it would throw him around, throw him to the ground, and the father even explained, he says sometimes it would just throw, you know, try to throw him in the fire, try to kill him. And the man actually didn't want to bother Jesus, I think. So he brought the boy first to the disciples. Well, the disciples couldn't cast the demons out, and they started bickering about each other, and they were debating. You know, you can kind of picture this theological debate. Well, you didn't say it right. Well, you're supposed to do this. And you could see these guys all, you know, talking about ministry and how you're supposed to cast out a demon, and they're getting all, you know. They later asked Jesus, of course, why couldn't we cast this demon out? And Jesus says, oh, you guys don't understand. This kind of demon can only be cast out through prayer. And it says that Jesus was a little bit disgusted with them. Because, you know, let's just think about it. If you're in a spiritual battle, don't you think somewhere along the line prayer would start to kick in? And Jesus says, oh, yeah. It's kind of like, oh, you want to know more about me? Oh, yeah, you need to read the Bible for that. You know, that's kind of, I think, what Jesus was saying. Oh, yeah, you have to pray. It's like, duh. So they couldn't cast it out, and then they just try and so forth. But apparently there was this ruckus in the situation, and Jesus goes to the disciples. He's frustrated with them. He's frustrated with their lack of faith. He's frustrated with their prayerlessness, and he tells them to bring the boy and the father to him. So this is where we pick up in chapter 9, verse 20. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? Now, by the way, Jesus already knew, okay? Just so you know, Jesus already knew. Many times when God asks us questions, even like in the, you know, Garden of Eden, Adam, where are you? God knows, you know, he knew. He wanted this dad to process all of this. The dad said, from childhood, he answered. It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. Now watch this. If you can, said Jesus. I mean, I'm reading between lines. If you can. I created the universe. I created every living thing, including humans. I mean, if you can, if I can. He says, if you can, everything is possible for one who believes. And I believe that message was for the man and the disciples, by the way. Everything is possible for one who believes. Immediately, the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. One of the most encouraging and uplifting stories in the Bible is this one. And I think this resonates in all of us because no matter how much faith we have or think we have, our faith is flawed, Our faith is imperfect. It's lacking. And this passage gives me permission to believe in God and still ask him to help me where I don't believe, where I'm struggling, where I'm, I want to trust you, and I sort of do, but I'm struggling with trusting you all the way. And I love it. Now, I'm going to challenge you to be honest as that man was, because I'm not going to give you a blank to this next little arrowed statement there, because this is for you. Now, if you're sitting too close to somebody and you're afraid they're going to look and peek on their paper, your paper, okay, you could put it in your mind or maybe just put initials or some kind of secret hieroglyphic. But here's the statement. I don't fully trust God, blank. Where is that area? So that's right? Is that in your notes? There it is. So I'll give you two spaces there. All right, so you can have, in case it's a list of names. All right? I don't fully trust God with, what might it be? For some of you, some of you know right away. Some of you know right away, you say, oh, that's easy, it's my kids. You know, their present, their future, their feelings about me, you know, I want them to forgive me, and they haven't. I want them to be assured they have their love and so forth. Some of you wake up every day and you battle fear. Maybe you battle fear that God isn't with you or for you, even though you believe in him and you know, you don't feel like, you know, you really know him or that he knows you, and you just, maybe you don't trust God fully with your money. Maybe that's one of the things. And you say, oh, that's embarrassing. That's hard for a lot of people. I think that's why Jesus talked about it so much. It's where we live, but it's also what we struggle with, because it represents our time and our effort, and it's what we use to care for ourselves, you know, to provide. So, hey, if that's your struggle, welcome to, you know, following Jesus. I mean, that's, again, you know, you've heard it. He talked more about money than heaven and hell combined. So you don't know that he's going to do what's best for you, you know? You think, wow, okay, things are already tight. This doesn't make sense mathematically. Things are already tight, so I'm going to give some to God, and then I'm going to do better than I'm doing now. See, that doesn't make sense, does it? Now, here's the key to this. Just be honest. Honesty is the beginning of being free. It's the beginning of liberation. And some of you trust God for your salvation, but you can't trust him for things that are far, far, far less important. And Galatians 5:1 says, it's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Now, I'm going to just get vulnerable a little bit and tell you, my biggest struggle of trust, this is ironic because I'm talking to you about this. My biggest struggle of trust, ironically, is Hillside. I think I'm far more necessary than I really am. That was tested big time this week, you know. And the truth of it is that, you know, getting sick and all this kind of stuff, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen? Like, the whole place is going to fall apart. No, it's not going to fall apart. Did you hear this group today? I mean, and I can't thank Brad enough for coming to the rescue. Very last minute, I thought he wasn't in town. I didn't think he was in the country. So I texted him, and I really literally didn't. And texted me, he goes, yeah, okay, I can help you out. And it was like, oh, see, God, you know. But I get myself so riled up thinking, oh, all of this has to happen with me or because of me. And, you know, and God reminds me. It's like, David, you realize you're just one bus from, you know, heaven. You know, just, right? Boom, there it is, okay? You know, one lightning strike, Zappo, okay? You know, and guess what? Things are going to go on without you. But, you know, because I love you, I worry about you. You know, I worry about people who aren't here. I worry about people who used to be here and aren't here. You know, it's like, what? Right? So I'm just being a little vulnerable here with you and being honest. But I have a hard time letting go, you know. And I have to remind myself, hey, here's the truth of it. God loves you and cares about you even more than I do. Okay? And that's just true. So whatever you wrote down on that line, have courage to be honest with it, do something about it. And we're going to talk about developing a wholehearted trust real quick. But first, let's take a look at the scripture I misquoted from the partially surrendered version. Here's the right way and the good way. Look at this. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, every struggle, every job, every neighborhood, future, relationships, whatever it is, in all your ways, acknowledge him and he will make your paths straight. Now, I think what's great that we're going to emphasize, that word acknowledge is a very, very important word. That word acknowledge, and I think, did I put that in there? Oh, yeah, I did. It's the Hebrew word yada. Now, not to be confused with Yoda, that's different, and not to be confused with yada, 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 okay? Seinfeld fans, all right? So anyway, yada is a Hebrew word. It's a very, very special Hebrew word, which means coming to know and submit by observing, reflecting, and experiencing. It's like, wow, all that in that little word, yes. It's trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding in everything and in every area of life. Come to know and to submit to him by observing, by reflecting, by experiencing Christ. Then God will make your journey, the Hebrew word there is yashar. He'll make it pleased. He'll make it smooth, straight, and right. God will not bring order to the chaos of your life until you yada him, know him. Now, let me tell you something. This Hebrew word, acknowledge, or to know, is not an intellectual knowledge. That's a totally different Hebrew word, to that academic, that intellectual knowledge. This is the same word used in Genesis, where in Genesis 4:1, it says, and Adam knew his wife, and she bore a child. Now, not going to go into details, but that was not a handshake and a how you doing. All right? That was intimate. Now, this isn't a sexual term, so you know. This is an intimacy term. This is an intimacy word. And that's what really God is emphasizing here. And whenever that word's used, it's that way. It's close. It's intimate. I know. Some of you would say, I've gotten to know my wife or my husband better through the years. Well, you already know him. Yeah, but I know him better. What do you mean you know him better? I know him intimately. I know him more closely. That's the idea. Intimate knowing. It's not a knowing about. It's knowing that intimacy. And so when we yada God, seeking to know him and to know his heart, he takes the sins we've committed, the mistakes of our lives, the crookedness of our journey, if we could say it that way, and he makes it straight. So here's our problem. Here's my problem. Is we want God to prove himself so we can trust him. That's our first problem. We want God to prove himself so we can trust him. God, I want you to prove your faithfulness before I trust you. And this seems reasonable, doesn't it? I mean, we're rational people. It really does. It becomes more of making deals with God, though, and that's the problem. God, if you give me this promotion or help me land this account, then I will serve you, right? Or how about this one? God, if you will help me win the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes, I will give you 10% of it. It's like, aren't you so generous? You know? Okay, more realistically, God, if you give me a raise, then I'll trust you with my money. But that's not how God works. See, this is really us, you know, making God, you know, a vending machine, really. Number two, God wants us to trust him so he can prove himself. See, God proves himself faithful as we place our trust in him. See, God giving you or I, if he gave you $10 million and then we give him $1 million back, that's not faith. That's us using God, again, as a vending machine and then giving him a tip. Thanks for the $10 million. Here's $1 million back. You know. See, Hebrews 11:1 really describes what is faith. Faith is this. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. I love that song, that new song, Give Me Faith, that we're singing. We're going to be doing a series in September. I'm going to use that as the theme because that's, I mean, it's like, Lord, I have faith in you. Help my lack of faith. Lord, I believe. Help me with my unbelief. God asks us to believe in what we cannot prove so that God can do what is beyond belief. Faith comes first. We believe in what we cannot see so God can do what we cannot do. Verse 6 in that same chapter of Hebrews talks about that without faith, it's impossible to please God. Impossible to please God. The African Impala, not to be confused with the Impala car, this is an animal. The African Impala right there is kind of an amazing animal. It's able to jump 10 feet high, and if it gets running, it can jump like 30 feet, you know, in length. Yet if you go into the zoo at the, you know, and see the African Impala, you could find it. They'll just have a small little fence, a 3-foot fence. They put a solid 3-foot fence around it. They can keep any impala in there without any effort. And you know why? Because it's ingrained in the impala to never jump someplace where they can't see where their feet are going to land. So consequently, they don't jump over the 3-foot fence because they cover it so that they can't see where their feet are going to land. I think we live that way sometimes. I think that sometimes we, you know, because we can't see, you know, we live that way. God, unless I know exactly how this is going to turn out, I'm not going to trust you. God, before I confess the sins, I've got to know that I'm not going to lose my marriage. See? Nope. No guarantees, God says. That takes the faith part away. I have to trust without seeing, and that's very hard, unless you yada God. See, if we know him intimately, we don't need to see where our feet are going to land. We know he's going to catch us. We know he's with us. We know wherever he's going, we want to go. The third thing is that perhaps the reason we don't trust him, why don't we trust him? This could be a possibility. Perhaps the reason we don't trust him is because we don't really know him. Now, if you have never accepted Christ as your Savior, if you've never accepted God's grace and his mercy, there is all kinds of reasons why you don't feel an assurance and a unabandoned trust in God. See, first accepting him and trusting him with your life, with your soul, that's step one. And we may know about him, but we don't really know him. So here's my challenge. Here's my challenge to those of you who are Christ followers, and maybe to those of you who aren't. The challenge is this: take a step of faith. In the next 48 hours, all right? So you know, by noon Tuesday. We get technical. But just take some kind of step of faith. Whatever you wrote on your line, whatever your issue is, finances, kids, future. Now, you're not going to solve the problem in the next 48 hours probably, but you can decide what step you can take in releasing that to God. It may start tonight with a prayer: God, I don't believe, help my unbelief. The problem or issue probably won't be solved, but you can take that step of faith. And you know what you'll find? Here's what you'll learn. When you take that a step of faith, what God delights in showing us. He delights in showing us three things here. He just likes showing us his goodness, the goodness of God. He loves to show us his love, the love of God, and the faithfulness of God. He loves to show that to us over and over. All of that is right here. In Psalm 100, you see that Psalm just magnifies that whole thing, that showing, talking about the goodness, the love, and the faithfulness of God. Look at this, Psalm 100, verse 3. Know that the Lord is God. It is he who made us, and we are his people. We are his people. See that? The sheep of his pasture. Then he says, enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him and praise his name. Now watch. For the Lord is good. You'll get to know his goodness. And his love endures forever. You'll get to know his love. His faithfulness continues through all generations. You see, you'll see his faithfulness. Now, isn't it interesting? It's not just about your life. It's not just about my life. It's through all generations. So when you trust God with your whole heart, that will impact your children and your grandchildren, he says, and your great-grandchildren. Their lives will be different because of the faith that you lived out. Now, hidden in this verse is, I think, really the key to slaying the Christian atheist in us. And you have to look closely and you have to think like an Israelite worshiping with psalms in the Bible days. You know, what are we? The Bible says there, the passage says that we are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Then what are we told to do? Enter his gates with thanksgiving. So if you're a sheep and you're entering the gates with thanksgiving, do you know when the sheep would enter the gates of the city? One time a year and for one purpose. It was one time a year and for one purpose that sheep would enter the gates of Jerusalem, enter the gates of the city. They would enter once a year for sacrifice. Now, we're his sheep, and we're to enter his gates, and if the purpose is sacrifice, that doesn't sound very enticing or enjoyable, does it? Why would I be thankful about that? Because when you and I, yada, really know God intimately, our life becomes a living sacrifice. So that every part of you is his, you will know that his goodness and his love and his enduring faithfulness, that you'll turn our hearts to praise and thanksgiving. So whatever you're having a hard time with, whatever you're having a difficult time letting go of, you can trust him in it far more than you can trust yourself. Now, if you're a follower of Jesus, let me ask you, does total surrender describe your relationship with God? Maybe you're like that dad who said, I believe, help my unbelief. Maybe you aren't even at that point yet. We can come to God with that. Let's bow.